Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your weekly libertarian take on news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. If you are tired of the terrible choices offered by today's politics, you have come to the right place. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my illustrious colleagues, Catherine Mangu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Matt Welch. The whole band's back together. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
Hi.
Hi, I would say hi, but I'm busy adjusting my volume for your screaming, but yes, go on.
That wasn't screaming. We bring volume as a benefit. That's part of the podcast. Happy Monday! Let's start with a segment that I want to call a Banana Republic, if you can keep it. One of the things you see in Banana Republics, one of the clearest marks of petty authoritarianism, is these authoritarians just nationalize stuff. Important industries, industries that a country should be proud of, businesses the leader just wants to claim as his own under the guise of making it for the people. To be fair, sometimes they don't literally nationalize things. They just exert so much control via regulation, tax policy, whatever it is, that it might as well be nationalized. Which brings me to President Donald Trump and Intel, the computer chip maker. So last week, reports indicated that the president might be interested in the federal government taking a stake in the computer chip company. This comes just after what have been described as profit sharing arrangements with the computer chip makers AMD and NVIDIA. Pentagon also bought a $400 million equity stake in a rare earth mining company, MP Materials, and the federal government earlier this year took what Trump called a golden share in U.S. steel as part of a deal to allow Japan's Nippon Steel to buy the American steelmaking company. So, Catherine, are we just nationalizing things now? Like, what is your Banana Republic rating for this week?
It's a lot of bananas. It's high number of a bunch of bananas, I guess. And it's extremely not good. Like, this is why people think they hate capitalism, because they think that this is the logical consequence of capitalism. It is not. This is, in fact, a horrific overgrowth of the state, like mold across the private sector. It's like the kind that gives you respiratory illnesses, probably.
Are we going to get Maha on that?
Yeah, like if we could get RFK on this, this would be great. No, this is extremely bad news. This is actually of the many, many thin ends of the many, many wedges that Trump has been experimenting with. This is actually the one that alarms me the most.
So say more about that. Why does it alarm you the most?
Because the only thing that's actually good in this world is like the technology sector in the United States. And I'm saying that, like, obviously as a slight overstatement, but not a huge one. I think, like, the place where the solutions to all of our problems will originate, if there are solutions, is the private sector, and especially the less regulated parts of the private sector, which have tended to be tech companies in recent years. And this will bring that to a screeching halt. If you have to kind of get government approval for everything that you do, either because of the golden share or the export or the import or the tariffs or all of these different constraints that Trump is rapidly piling on in ways that are much more up to the discretion of a single individual, everyone's just going to stop doing weird stuff. And the only way that we save ourselves is by doing weird stuff until one of the weird things works.
So, Nick, Catherine says that the only good thing in the world is the U.S. tech sector. And it's like puppy dogs. Negronis.
They'll be made better by the tech sector, for sure.
But in fact, Intel had not been doing well. It was not a company that was doing well in the U.S. tech sector, even as the U.S. tech sector has kind of kept the economy afloat. And this is one of the arguments that you see going around is, I just want to read you something from an analyst named Gil Luria, who talked to CNBC about this. Just an incredible quote. "We're all capitalists. We don't want government to intervene and own private enterprise, but this is national security."
Right.
Doesn't it always like make you kind of just like tense up and upset when somebody says we're all capitalists, but...
I'm already tense enough where you can bounce quarters off my chest around my heart. That didn't land very well.
It's a good visual.
I don't even understand that metaphor, but let's keep going.
That's because you've never made your bed, I'm expecting.
In any case,
if you go back to the Nippon U.S. Steel deal with the golden share, that crossed a line that really hadn't been crossed probably ever, but certainly not in recent times, where the U.S. government, and it wasn't the U.S. government, it's Trump saying, we're not going to let this happen unless you give me, you know, and kind of the government veto power over all kinds of decisions you'll be making as a business. That is awful and screwed up and wrong. With this, when you have, particularly with the NVIDIA deal, which is not a profit sharing thing, it's a revenue sharing thing. And basically Trump is saying, like, we will let you export this particular chip to China, which is a national security risk, but we're going to let you do it if you give us 15% of everything that you sell. This is like mobsterism. I mean, this is gangsterism. It's stupid. It's bad. It's anti-capitalist. It's anti-libertarian for sure. It's part and parcel of a world in which every deal coming in or coming out of the country has to, you know, you have to swing by Trump and drop off a packet of cash. I mean, it's bad, and it is different. It is different than the way the Biden administration was doing things, where it was like at every moment they were trying to insert themselves in every transaction, you know, when it came to designing things and regulating the tech sector or the you know, what kind of plugs your computer and appliances have. That is all bad. This is equally bad and in a different way. But the good news is, like, the NVIDIA deal almost certainly won't actually pass legal scrutiny, because the government is not allowed to create export controls that are, you know, contingent on one company kicking back to them on a particular product. But it is simultaneously incredibly bad and something that any of us who were critics of Donald Trump have seen coming in one way or another.
In fact, there's at least some reporting from Bloomberg that Intel, which already got nearly $8 billion from the CHIPS Act, if you remember that, under the mm-hmm. Biden administration, that in fact, the way that they would pay for the quasi-nationalization, the stake in Intel that is reported to be maybe happening here, is that they would use leftover funds from the CHIPS Act. So this is just a straightforward continuation of Biden's terrible economic policy. Matt, there's a bunch of people saying, well, look, it's not that big a deal. Like, maybe it's not a great policy, but this isn't nationalization. This is just tax policy. We do import-export taxes all the time. What's the big deal? I mean, not the Intel part of this, but like for NVIDIA and AMD, like the 15% share.
So companies, corporations, they should be paying attention firstly and foremostly, and secondly and second mostly, to their customers and to their shareholders. And when you introduce the government as being part of that, then that changes that equation entirely. This is part of our objection to the bailout of General Motors, government motors. It changes the incentive structure. It also changes the incentive structure for failing companies to say, hey, put rare earth metals in your description. Right? That's what newspapers should do from now
on.
Your
breakfast cereal, right?
Like, your face the Washington cream. Post needs money, like it's the Washington Rare Earth Minerals Post. Wink, wink. And they'll get some money from the federal government. It introduces inefficiency. It makes, as Nick was saying, it makes you reorient what you're doing to attract the pleasure of one person, of this president. So you go flatter him. You go show up with a gold medal and put it on his desk and give him a hamburger. And then he's going to exempt you from this tariff or maybe have this golden share. There was, in the broad sweep of international geopolitics and economics in the 1970s and 1980s, a very big kind of intellectual fight. And it was between, on one hand, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, and on the other hand, Francois Mitterrand and a bunch of old commies, or just socialists, let's say.
And your favorite people.
Francois Mitterrand nationalized a bunch of stuff back then, nationalized a bunch of companies. We needed golden shares. We needed outright ownership of various things. Meanwhile, Thatcher and Reagan and Carter before him was in the process of doing deregulation. And in the case of England, it was more like we got to stop owning stuff. And we got to see, it was this wonderful real world experiment for about 10 years there. What's the difference between these countries? And by the end of it, also, by the way, communism fell, and it was revealed to be much worse economically as an idea than anyone had any notion of believing, except for the most hardcore anti-commies among us. So we had this natural experiment. And after that, what happened? All the places, including France, in Western Europe, went on the world's biggest privatization binge. Trillions of dollars worth of stuff was privatized. Golden shares were thrown into the trash where they belong. That is the insight that we learned, and we are now busy unlearning it, and we're now busy justifying it by saying, oh, it's just tax policy. Oh, this is rare earth metals, minerals. That means we can suspend everything. This is national security. It's all BS. You are using it to rationalize what you know in your heart is bad economics. Some people perhaps don't know in their heart that it's bad economics and they wield power, but there's a lot of people who know a lot better who are sitting on their hands as we're in the nationalization business in this country. And it's pathetic.
I think one of the, if I may, just to follow up on that real quick, you know, one of the things that blurs this for people or obscures this, besides either their absolute hatred for Donald Trump or their love and adoration of him, is that he is not a systems guy. So with him, you know, it's the same thing like when he, you know, in foreign policy, like he'll bomb Iran, but he won't necessarily, he's not following a philosophy. So that means, okay, the next thing is boots on the ground, etc. I think with his economic policy, it's similar too. Like he does love tariffs. He won't shut up about tariffs, but he will do this for certain companies and certain deals. But because it's not systematic and because he does not have a philosopher king who is explaining why this is, he's going to map this into every corner of the known universe, it becomes difficult to fight in a way because there are almost always one-off exceptions, any of his particular actions. But when you look at it, it does create this kind of thuggish banana democracy kind of feel where it's not, you know, it isn't about I'm executing, you know, the best version of communism or the best version of capitalism. He's not Javier Milei. And it's this weird, you know, cult of personality that he's building. And it's very destructive of, you know, individual businesses. And then in the cumulative effect, it's really, it's just ultimately destructive of all kinds of concepts of a rule of law or of a, you know, the great thing about America is that we live in a system, you know, we're ruled by laws, not by men. But it makes it hard to say definitively this one thing is where things must stop.
Well, it all feeds into, it's not a philosophy, it's not a worldview, it's not an ideology in the sense that libertarianism or communism are ideologies. But the Trump's position here, the way I think he sees everything, is that it is a series of deals that he personally makes. That's how he understands America, its place in the world. That's how he understands the American economy, right? You see that's true with the tariffs, all the individual deals that his administration's been trying to make. Also goes back to the first term when he was personally announcing factory openings, which, yes, I know he's not like the very first politician to ever do this, but it was just like, here is my deal that I am making for America. And I don't think he really conceives of the economy outside of his deal making, outside of like his role as the middleman, because he loves making those deals. This is the thing that makes him like the most excited as president. I think you just see this all over. But with the tariffs, you know, most particularly, like go back and think about how he was talking about Gaza. We're going to redevelop it, right? Like we're going to take it over. We're going to make it like this beautiful, like it's again, he just thinks about things like a real estate development guy. And I don't think it's working. I don't think that the numbers, which, yes, have been good for the first 6 months, are going to hold up. And in fact, this brings me to my next question, which is that last week we saw some new price data and it showed that the price of American made goods is rising. Right. So you had the producer price index, which measures the prices paid to domestic producers for their output. And it climbed by 0.9% just last month. That's way above what it was supposed to climb. And that's about 3.3% on an annualized basis. So we are seeing the price of American made goods go up, right? And this is food, this is electronics, it's stuff people actually buy. And so, Catherine, weren't tariffs supposed to only affect foreign imports and make things better for American made goods?
That's what I was told. But then Eric Boehm told me that was wrong, and he turned out to be correct. So, I mean, I think the other thing that's happening here is we still have one more number dump that's going to be good for Trump, which is right now a lot of companies are holding goods in customs warehouses and bonded warehouses, because they're hoping that this tariff stuff is going to settle out in their favor. They're hoping that it's going to turn out that they don't have to pay high tariffs. Eventually, they're going to let those goods go. And when they do, they will be paying high tariffs on them. And Trump's going to be able to say, look at all this tariff revenue. And I think that's short term. And I think, obviously, all this tariff revenue, first of all, doesn't take a chunk out of our deficit and also raises prices on goods for Americans in the end. But I'm a little bit worried about that phase. Like, yes, it's true, some prices on American made goods are going up, but the markets don't hate the Intel deal. You know, Intel's stock price is up. And I think Trump is going to be able to point to tax revenue in the next few months and say tariff revenue, because tariffs are taxes, and say, look, it worked. Any minute now, we're going to start funding the federal government using tariff revenue. I was right. And so I think that's still ahead of us to grapple with.
Trump definitely likes economic data that is good for him. But something he doesn't like is economic data that doesn't make him look good. For example, the jobs report. So we've already talked about on this podcast about how he fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics after a bad jobs report. Last week, we got the name of his pick to replace the top person at the BLS. And this is economist E.J. Antoni, who's from the Heritage Foundation, a guy who's been very critical of BLS reports over the past couple of years. And it's basically implied that there's a political slant to them, that there's a bias because of some of the downward revisions under the Biden administration. And he's also suggested at times that maybe the way to fix the job report data is just to not release the monthly reports. So, Matt Welch, I want to go back to you. What is your Banana Republic rating on this one? What do you consider like the more Banana Republican, Republic-y action here? Firing the head of the BLS, firing the head of the BLS and replacing him with a toady, or, you know, soft nationalizing the computer chip industry?
Probably the soft nationalization has more of an impact. The firing the BLS toady is they're going to keep finding people to fire or to pin blame on. Jerome Powell is going to be the most obvious one, and that's just going to keep ramping up over time to blame for economic numbers. And it's not just prices starting to go up. It is the political reaction to it. And Harry Enten over at CNN, who's a pretty good numbers guy, pointed out a couple of days ago that Trump is already underwater on inflation. Like, the numbers have absolutely tanked in just the last 2 to 3 years in terms of voters associating Republicans with being kind of the problem for high prices. And that is with just not a huge amount of price increases, definitely some huge corporate losses in auto companies in particular, but not huge increases because a lot of these things, as Catherine's pointing out, are waiting because they're in warehouses, or Trump is saying, I'm going to do the tariff. Let's suspend it until October. And so we keep seeing this happen. And so if these things start having their full effect in the fall and in the winter, or even next spring, and then there's a midterm election, it's going to create an interesting dynamic. So, yes, he's going to be doing these things. I dislike terms like a banana republic. Not that it's wrong, but I just personally dislike using them because I think everyone wants to accelerate towards something that sounds frightening. We saw this in his first term and we still see it now with people talking about fascism. And there's definitely more authoritarianism in the second term than in the first one. And I'm sure we'll talk about more of that a little bit later. But just as a personal thing, I think we can say that the firing of a BLS bureaucrat is bad without hyperventilating to, you know, we're in the Jason Stanley multiverse of triple fascism right now.
No, because I don't think anybody on this podcast, for instance, is saying we're not in Jason Stanley territory, if only because we can't afford the tickets to Canada. Yeah. But it's, you know, it is true. Trump is acting like an idiot, baby dictator of what he would call a shithole country. And I think it's good to call attention to that. The idea that you will fire somebody because they give you the numbers using the same system that's been used for a long time, and which ultimately, when you look at work by economists like Jeremy Horpital and whatnot, who keep pointing out that actually Republican presidents have benefited from BLS numbers more than Democratic presidents have in terms of the way the revisions go, you know, this is bad stuff and we need to call attention to it. I think it's hard, you know, in a broader sense, it's hard to maintain the outrage on a certain level because you don't want to go full bulwark where it's just like, if anybody ever says anything like, you know, the weather is nice today, it's like, how can you be enjoying today when Donald Trump is in the White House? Like, that's, you know, that's a type of derangement which is not helpful to anything other than like your subscriber base, right? But, you know, there has to be, a constant calling out of the bullshit. And, you know, the type of things that he is doing again and again and again, like, you know, it's enough already.
Let's move on here. But I mean, it's true. There have been big revisions in BLS data, and like we should think about how to about what to do about that. This is a result of declining survey responses. It's just a lot harder to collect survey data now than it was 20 years ago. But this is a methodology problem. It's a data collection problem, and you don't solve that problem by hiding the data or by installing a flunky who just only tells you what you want to hear. Okay, so let's talk about something else that's going on in Washington, D.C. Trump is continuing to deploy federal troops in the Capitol as part of a crackdown that he says is intended to fight crime in the city. The president has declared state of emergency. He's put the D.C. Police Department under federal control. And over the weekend, hundreds of National Guardsmen from Ohio, South Carolina, and West Virginia were called up to police the Capitol. Trump has hinted about doing this in other big Democratic cities like Chicago, like New York, like Baltimore. It kind of seems like this is part of a strategy to put pressure on Democrats before the midterm election next year. Like, he's done this before, but he wants to make them look soft on crime. Catherine, you live in Washington, D.C., at least sometimes. Does he have anything like a point about crime in D.C.?
I mean, I think this is actually gets to what we were just talking about in the last segment. I have been in many conversations recently where everyone's official position on whether or not there is crime in DC maps perfectly onto their opinions about Donald Trump's presidency. And that is probably a sign that something is wrong. It's now just kind of after the fact justification of whether my team is right or your team is right. The element to me, the quantitative kind of hard information we have that suggests that this is not working or is not targeted correctly at a real problem is we had on Thursday, we had 1,750 officers and agents participating in a federal crackdown. That's a huge number of people. And the number of arrests that they made was the same number of a typical adult arrests in a day in 2024. There were 55 adult arrests on average in 2024, according to the city's police department, and there were something like 50 that night. That's not what happens if there is, in fact, rampant disorder and law breaking and 1,800 law enforcement officers walking around. So there has to be a disconnect somewhere. My bias is to say that DC is not uniquely dangerous and certainly not so dangerous as to justify this variety of unconstitutional or very nearly unconstitutional actions.
I mean, crime is higher than in many places in D.C. Crime in D.C. is higher than in a lot of parts of the country. At the same time, it has also come down considerably just in the last couple of years after spiking during the pandemic. Matt Welch, you have sometimes noted disorder issues in New York City. Would you welcome a National Guard troop buildup, troop surge, something like that? Is there something like this that some sort of, and forget even the Trump aspect of this, that any kind of politician could do just as a sort of, like, we're going to take big dramatic action right now that would, is there something that you would say, hey, that might actually work to deal with some of the issues that you have talked about in New York City?
Fred Young, cover your ears. Fuck no.
Yeah.
Fuck no. Fuck no. Fuck no. 17 times fuck no. What are we talking about here? The federal government sending in the military into American cities to fight crime? That's insane.
That's what Batman's for.
That's what Batman's for. Absolutely correct.
Okay, so we would welcome Batman taking like this as a private billionaire fighting crime with his awesome car.
Well, we don't know he's a billionaire.
Yeah,
he's canonically a billionaire.
I think well, no, we don't know. We, the citizens of Gotham, don't know.
Yeah. To separate some issues here, you asked about New York, where I live. Used to live in D.C., also used to live in L.A. L.A. is a place where Trump sent in the National Guard and the Marines against the wishes of the mayor and the governor. That was the Rubicon. We haven't really crossed that in a very, very long time, basically since the desegregation era in the South. And so that is a lot more of an aggressive act than in D.C. because the federal government has operational control over D.C. D.C., the history of the District of Columbia governance is such an appalling hodgepodge of this president doing that and this president doing that and somehow Senator Bilbo in the middle of all of it for decades. It is terrible. It is really terrible. Home rule hasn't worked. The thing that LBJ tried before that didn't work. So it's been a mess for a long time. And I think we can recognize that. I am tentatively in favor of retrocession to have the parts of D.C. sent back to Maryland the way that Virginia was able to successfully regobble Alexandria and Arlington back in the 19th century. It seems to me really weird that people live in a place that they can't necessarily vote on the representatives who affect the policy of the place. They do some, but not others. And it's just very strange and it's bad and it's not being governed well. And you're doing it by the whims now, again, of a single person. He wants to do that in American cities and states, sending in the military, people who are in some cases masked. This is happening already with ICE patrols. Sometimes they're plain clothes and they're stopping people in the street and they're wrestling them down. They're tearing down signs saying that, you know, we don't like this or that part of the law enforcement action. This is all very bad. It is all very obviously bad. We shouldn't want the military, which is trained to defend us from other countries attacking us, deployed in such a manner outside of crisis and out over the against the wishes of local governments. There should be city and state and county governments that have impact and control over basically the policing in their area. That is just kind of a normal thing to happen. Yes, you have federal law enforcement and the FBI. They're covering interstate stuff, but this is not a proper use, I do not believe, of federal government at all. And you heard Trump telegraph this a month or two ago, and it's like, yeah, we need to use this in big Democratic cities. He wasn't even like sugarcoating it at all. He's just like, where's a Democrat? Okay, there was even a Homeland Security person was just sort of listing Democratic cities the other day. Yeah, we have to do this in, like, I don't know, Chicago, obviously, and New York, and Boston. Like, Boston has had 11 murders in like 10 years. It's incredible how much crime has gone down in Boston. I don't even understand it.
Admittedly, that's partly an artifact of the way that that Boston's city lines are drawn. The city of Boston is actually, like, there's a whole bunch of other places that are not technically Boston.
You put Suderman into Boston for like a couple months and he becomes a Boston splainer. Obvious turn of events.
No, it's all bad.
This is, what this reminds me of is, it's like a weird through the looking glass of the, it was Madeleine Albright, right? That said, like, oh, we have this big military. Why don't we use it? Do you remember that quote?
Yeah.
What's the use of this great military for the military industrial complex?
It's just like, oh, well, we have these National Guards just like sitting around. Why don't we use them? Like that it's bringing that same energy, but of course, twice as horrifying because it's, using them against American citizens.
America? Yeah.
So there's like, to go back to what Matt was talking about, like, and separating out things. One is like, okay, let's talk about D.C., a place where I've lived as well. D.C. is, has a higher crime rate than a lot of other cities of its size. And its stature as the nation's capital, you want it to be safe. You want people, I heard, I think it was Steve Hayes at the Dispatch talking about how he once took his family to the Washington Monument or something, and there was a bum taking a crap in front of them. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's probably not, you're not going to put that on a souvenir placemat or something. There is a certain amount of public order that needs to be maintained. Trump's specific warrant for going into D.C. was the rising violent crime rate. According to the stats that are available, and there's always questions about them, DC is now at the rate of violent crime it was in 1966. It's come down precipitously. So we know that he is lying about the specifics of why he went in. Okay. Having said that, DC people should deal with DC crime. And, you know, because DC is funded by the government, they should have the appropriate amount of money or shift around whatever they're wasting money on to fight crime. That's all well and good. That has nothing to do with Donald Trump and the presidency. And when you have to realize, I think it was Jack Schaefer who talked about how whenever Trump did something outrageous in his first term, you had to remember to look back at what he was trying to get you to stop talking about. And I think that is, this is a textbook case of that. So it's like DC crime can be an issue. You can debate that. That's really for DC people. He's the president of the United States. And this is effectively the same thing as talking about a stoplight on Main Street in the middle of nowhere USA blinking weirdly. It isn't, you know, Trump should be focusing on things like the budget, focusing on things like foreign policy, focusing on actually, you know, fixing the way that the government works, or, you know, following up on DOGE and things like that. This is clearly a political ploy. It may be successful to the degree that Democrats are like, how dare you say anything, like all of our cities are fine. But that doesn't take away from the fact that this is a massive and obvious political ploy on the part of Trump that we should not get too mired in, because the big things that are the problems are like, I don't know, you know, like Medicare and Social Security. Actual security, the fact that, as Billy Binion had a great piece at Reason, you know, that people who are escaping from socialist countries are showing up here, going through the legal asylum process and then being sent back to places like Venezuela and Cuba. You know, those are the issues that Donald Trump is responsible for and needs to be held accountable for.
Well, since you bring up the Democratic response, I just want to ask you and Matt, actually, we all think this is bad. Matt's F-no, right? Like, was pretty unequivocal here. No one is like, this is maybe there's a justification for this or anything like this. At the same time, we just had a conversation about how maybe we shouldn't overreact. We shouldn't be using terms like banana republic, which is how I started this podcast. Right, Nick, I think you used the word thug in an earlier response, right? And so you have Democratic lawmakers from Virginia and Maryland who have called the police takeover, quote, a soft launch of authoritarianism, or maybe it's for authoritarianism, right? Like, but this is soft launch authoritarianism. And then there's other Democrats who are like, well, this is a nothing burger. We should ignore it here. But Nick, Matt, I just want to ask you guys, if you're so opposed to this, what is the proper way to respond to this that is correctly calibrated to the kind of threat that it represents?
To be clear, I'm opposed to, because your original question was New York City, where I live and which is not operated by the federal government. The federal government does not belong sending the military into American cities over which it does not have any jurisdiction. It has jurisdiction, including over policing in some cases in the nation's capital. So that becomes a problem. And I think a lot of people block out the governance problem of the District of Columbia or speed up towards some imagined future, which is kind of hard to figure out. So Trump has some ability. The Congress and the executive branch has some authority to be able to do this. I still don't like it. I still will go out of my way to avoid Washington, D.C. unless and until Catherine tells me to come there, because it horrifies me to see military vehicles on an American street. I don't want to be anywhere where my papers are going to be asked ever. And I can't, the idea fills me with apoplectic rage. That said, and this is kind of the problem with making everything about Trump at all times, and Trump making everything about his decisions at all times, it forces every single American citizen, per what Nick was saying about stoplights in the middle of nowhere, to have their 10-point plan for how to solve crime in Washington, D.C. I don't have a 10-point plan of how to solve crime in Washington, D.C. I was mugged the first day I was in Washington, D.C. I don't have a fond memory of that, and a bunch of other stuff besides. And as
was
mentioned
president?
Before, what's that?
Who was president?
That was on election day of 2000. So, you know, the whole country
That's
was not mugged.
Clear. Yeah, we didn't have a president for like the next 8 years.
I think Ralph Nader was president of Washington, D.C. on that one special night.
This was the libertarian dream day. No president.
Yeah, that's right. I have been thinking about this and this large question that you're talking about, Peter, in the context of the movie Idiocracy, which, you know, came out in 2005 or 2006. Matt talked about it as his consumption choice a couple of weeks ago. And there's a moment where, you know, the Luke Wilson character finally gets people, like, he can't convince them that Brondo, which is being sprayed on the crops, is killing them and is kind of making them all stupid. But then he just goes out and shows them, like, let's use water to water the crops rather than Brondo. And then everything starts turning around. And I've been puzzling over this kind of question of, like, when do we reach a Brondo moment where the, you know, the political discourse fundamentally shifts away from, like, goddamn Donald Trump. Like, I'm starting to hear versions of, remember when he was elected and people were like, you know, this fucker gets his steak cooked well done and then puts ketchup on it. I have to move to Canada, or, you know, I have to move to Barcelona to get away from this type of stuff. Like, that level of, you know, idiocy and derangement is starting to crop up again, partly because he's worse this time around than he was the first time around. But we have
he's certainly more empowered.
Yeah, and, you know, the clock is running on him because, you know, after the midterms, and it will be unlikely that the Republicans will hold stuff, but even unless they massively increase their majorities, you know, he's a lame duck. So he knows that the clock is ticking on him. But we need that Brondo moment where we start to reset and actually talk about policy rather than politicians and things like that. And I think by noting, you know, that D.C. does have a crime problem, and, violent crime is lower than it was during his first term, where he didn't feel a need to, you know, bring the National Guard in. You can criticize his moment. You can, you know, tell the people of D.C., yeah, you really should focus on fixing crime and things like that. And then, like, the main thing is, though, is, like, the president needs to be the president of the United States, and he needs to start looking at the big issues that are screwing things up and criticizing those.
I think he just wants to be the super mayor of all the cities. I mean, this is the thing that he has been focused on long before he was involved in politics.
He alone can fix it.
He wants to be super mayor and super real estate deal maker for all of America. Mm. Every deal just goes straight through him. Every city policy goes straight through him. This is what he was like when he was in New York before he was in politics, complaining about the Central Park Five. This is something he's run on for forever here. Like, this is how he has always conceived of America, of his role in it. He just wants to be the guy who makes the decisions about all the deals and all the crime and all the cities. And maybe we do need a Brondo moment for that. I think we've got a couple more Brondo moments coming up right after this, including a listener question about us. These days, it feels like there's advice for everything. Cold plunges, gratitude journals, screen detoxes. But how do you know what actually works for you? With the internet and information overload about mental health and wellness, it can be a struggle to know what's true and what actions to take. Using trusted resources and talking to live therapists can get you personalized recommendations and help you break through the noise. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform. It serves over 5 million people globally, and it works. There's an App Store rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client reviews. It's also convenient. You can join a session with a therapist at the click of a button. It helps you fit therapy into your busy life. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. As the world's largest online therapy provider, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Talk it out with BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/roundtable. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. All right, this week's listener question comes from Leonard, who asks, if you were a band, who would play what? Also, since I'm sure Matt has a binder full of options, what would it be called? Bonus points if you can work in Peter playing the sousaphone. I guess we know what instrument I'm playing. Catherine, I'm going to start with you because you love assigning reasoned staffers like roles in fictional groups based on personality assessments.
I do. I do enjoy that a lot.
Yeah.
My mind first went to, what if we were like a K-pop idol group? Because I feel like that's actually where we need to be. I don't know if you all are part of the K-pop Demon Hunter cultural moment that is occurring, but if you have a tween in your house, maybe so. So I've got K-pop on my mind. I'm not like as familiar with the different roles in K-pop groups, but the way I understand it is that each of you kind of has like a persona that the fans like glom onto. And the main thing that I imagine is that Nick is the one person in the K-pop group that raps.
Yeah, no, you nailed it. Nailed
that's,
it.
That's what came to me. I think in a sort of classic band scenario, Peter is clearly the bassist, and after that, it gets blurry.
I did, in fact, play bass guitar. Matt Welch, since you were name checked,
name of the band is obviously Brando Moment.
That's
just obvious.
With our number one hit, Electrolytes. It's what clients crave.
Electrolytes and Dyna Girl. I would play, like Mickey Hart, I would play the gong, which I would use to pound whenever the host of the roundtable chooses a particularly bad question to answer. And then I would also, but more seriously, I love playing piano and I'm very bad at it. And that is a deadly That's combination. And so what I would do is like, mid to late Brian Wilson era Beach Boys, I would be on stage playing the piano, loving every minute of it, and nothing would be plugged in. So no one would want to hear what I was doing.
Matt, who's the Al Jardine of the Reason Roundtable?
I'm not at liberty to discuss. Robbie Suave, I think.
Who is Al Jardine?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Nick, do you have an answer here?
No, I was just thinking, though, of because I asked, like, what names be? And immediately I thought of the Brian Jonestown Massacre and John Cougar Concentration Camp. But... yeah, other than that, I am beyond atonal. So I was going to opt out to be the Brian Epstein of the Reason Roundtable. So that I merely make deals and come up with marketing ploys rather than actually appear on stage.
I would like Nick to be the dancing hype man's in the ska band. Nice.
The Klaus Nomi the Reason Roundtable.
In general, I think it's clear that we would in fact be some kind of band that is like... moderately self-aware about its ridiculousness. Like we would be like Guar or something.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah.
Like that's our niche.
I think it's
we're not like Guar already.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, not like Guar.
When are we going to feed Jerry Springer to the blood monster?
If you have not watched the Tiny Desk concert, the NPR Tiny Desk concert with Guar yet, do today. It will lighten your mood no matter how depressed you are about everything. The Guar Tiny Desk concert is quite wonderful.
I think go ahead, sorry.
No, I just want to say I picked this question partly because I thought it was funny. We're all here today for the first time in a couple of weeks. There's going to be a guest for the next couple of weeks. Matt Welch is going to be in the host chair. It's going to be great, folks. but I did think like there's something to this question about comparing podcast panels to bands. And I think that a lot of the kind of podcasts that are popular, especially sort of niche popular, right? They're not the very biggest hits, but they have big followings, right? Dedicated followings. They can pack the Comedy Cellar in New York when they go and play, like we did just a couple of weeks ago. Like there is a substantial overlap, a kind of transference of the energy that went into a particular kind of indie band fandom that I am very familiar with as an elder millennial that like defined my life in high school and the early aughts, where I would follow around these bands that would... like they struggled to put 1,000 people in a room. On the other hand, there were 200 people in every single city who would go see them play in a yoga studio. Yes, I am talking about the Dismemberment Plan, but not only the Dismemberment Plan. And there is something kind of fun to be part of that kind of a group, having that kind of energy in a podcast. And I do think that like people who are like, man, music is really, it's sad these days. There's no originality. Like what happened to pop music, right? Like there is some truth to the decline of the kind of pop music. Like that narrative has a little bit of truth, but that energy has gone into a different place culturally. And a lot of what it has gone into is four people talking on a podcast. And it's there's a bunch of similarity there that I don't think people have quite fully processed yet.
When do we get to the Fleetwood Mac part where we just sing songs about how we hate each other?
I think
that's where we start.
Well, since my romantic relationship with Matt went downhill, my songs are angrier now.
Yeah, there's a lot of pointed eye contact on certain helpful lyrics.
He can go his own way.
We are all going to be yoked together by the chain here. Reminder, we do love to answer your questions and make Fleetwood Mac references. We love to answer them so much that we are answering even more of your questions on YouTube. You should check out our YouTube channel if you have not. To submit your question for consideration, please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long email to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. Okay, let's finish out by talking about the Trump-Putin meeting that happened in Alaska. There was no deal, but Trump now wants a peace agreement, not a ceasefire. Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky set to meet with Trump in Washington today, and a cadre of European officials are going to join him. Reportedly,
speaking
to
about
create
a kind of femme K-pop band is showing up in D.C. today.
Just going to have to wait and see what the music video looks like. All right. So by the time you hear this podcast, that meeting's going to be over. We don't know exactly what's going to happen here. But Nick, before last week's summit in Alaska, Trump said Putin would face severe consequences if he didn't agree to stop the war or sort of come closer to making a peace agreement. But Putin agreed to nothing. And Trump seems to have backed down from his threats and even started adopting some of Putin's language here. There's no consequences for Putin. The people who said Trump was going to get rolled look like they were kind of right here. So what does this tell you?
Two things. And the first is, I think that, you know, broadly, that seems to be what it's like coming out of this. We don't know how he's going to be talking with Zelensky and, you know, the minor crown princes of Europe today. And I hope that it is something like, you know, that is not as bad as his Truth Social post, where he was basically, he publicly said over the weekend that there's only one person who can stop this war immediately, and it's Zelensky, basically by giving up, by surrendering unconditionally. That's not a good way to broker any kind of meaningful end to this conflict, I think. And that does not imply like that the U.S. should be arming Ukraine or anything like that. I'm just saying, from a negotiator point of view, it's disturbing when you don't have, one of the main countries involved in a war at the table when you're talking about settlements and things like that. So I'm hoping, against all appearances, that Trump is actually playing three-dimensional chess here. He gave a long and kind of insane interview to Sean, on Fox News. Thank you. Where he spent as much time basically talking about how the 2020 election was stolen and that Putin totally agreed with him. Putin agreed with him, you know, you can't have mail-in ballots. It was like unhinged. One of the things that he said in that, though, that was pretty interesting, and I take at his face value, is that Trump does want wars to end, and he is not eager to inject America fully into situations, which I think is good. From a kind of restrained foreign policy point of view, Trump is not bad. Part of the problem is the inconsistency and also the massive inconsistency and interventionist tendencies of the U.S. in Ukraine, among other places, over the past 15 years or so. But having said that, you know, the one thing is, I take Trump at his face value. He wants to stop wars. And I hope that that mixes with a positive, you know, with a good discussion with Zelensky and the European leaders, who need to be doing more to actually bring this war to an end, which is not going to be. I don't think Putin is going to get everything he wants. And I don't think that Ukraine will be what it was before 2014.
Matt, you have written a lot about foreign policy, especially in Europe. You are a pretty vehement Putin is bad guy, but you're also not like a big like wars. You know, sometimes you just need to do wars. They're great kind of guy. And it just so I want to ask you actually the same question I asked Nick last week about the kind of two main paths that people go down when they think about this conflict. Right. And the first one is, look, allowing Putin to take some territory in the Donbas is maybe worth it if it leads to peace and it stops the killing, right? It's and then the other one is that giving in to Putin in any way at all, giving him territory that he doesn't yet have military control of, is appeasement. It rewards an authoritarian leader for a brutal war of aggression that he started, right? And it might embolden him to future aggression. So sort of where do you situate yourself in between those two theories of this conflict?
Primarily that it's not for me to decide, and it shouldn't be for America to decide either. It's for Ukrainians to decide that. What America needs to decide is, are we going to give them, continue to give them funding and weaponry as they try to defend themselves? And when you give a disproportionate amount of that, you have some say in, okay, I will do this if you're defending yourself, but I'm not going to do this if you're going to cling on trying to get the Eastern Donbass. That's not my position, but that's a position that an administration can take. I think the key for me about what is going to happen later today, and we're probably not going to see what I would like to see, but I think what it could be is a transference of primary responsibility from the United States to Europe. Europe, which makes a lot of noises about Trump, which a lot of European leaders or, you know, one level below the leadership roles have been kind of sniping about Trump rolling out the red carpet and being very nice to Putin. And now with his Truth Social that Nick referenced, and everything else. And you can snipe at that. I get it. But also, this is something that's happening in Europe. Why is the United States a primary responsibility here? This is so overdue. We've known who Trump is for 10 years. We've known his sort of proclivities against international institutions that the U.S. helped build after World War II. He thinks of these as kind of scams that people have been free riding off of. And there's some truth to that. Like, Europeans have been able to free ride off American security forever. And when you free ride off people, you can snipe a lot about it and not take primary responsibility. So I hope that the presence of the K-pop European leaders in Washington alongside of Zelensky is going to lead to kind of a bifurcation of this. Trump, if Trump really believes that Zelensky is the problem, then those European leaders can say, OK, cool, that's your opinion. Our opinion is that he's not, and that we want to continue funding Ukraine. We'll take up the slack now and do this instead. We will be the ones primarily responsible for that. One little thing I want to mention also, which is very strange, and again, this is what happens when you personalize all of policy into one person. So a lot of people on the kind of anti-war and pro-Trump side of this have portrayed this war as being kind of primarily America's fault by dangling potential NATO membership people saying that, like, you know, basically we provoked Putin into this war. I think that's wrong, but Let's say that it's even halfway true. One thing that Trump suggested to Putin in Alaska was that the U.S. now would be interested in providing Article 5 like security guarantees for Ukraine. Like, what? What? We've been saying that NATO membership is the thing that we provoked him. And now instead, we're just going to provide a security guarantee that Biden, among other presidents, had ruled out previously. What are you even talking about now? So it'll be interesting to see people's heads explode. I'm guessing that there are a lot of people who are trying to compete for Donald Trump's be the last person in the room speaking to Donald Trump and trying to affect his decision, Marco Rubio among them, who sounded a lot different before he was Secretary of State about this issue than he does now. Overall thing is that this shouldn't be our primary responsibility. I don't have a lot of hope that this is going to lead to anything like the ending of the war. Trump obviously made a lot of threats that he did not follow up on with Putin. So Putin should be, from his point of view, like, why should he change at all based on this? And I just hope that Trump and J.D. Vance, who's also going to be there today, obviously, don't do a rerun of their treatment of Zelensky in February, which I think was shameful and a stain on America.
Catherine, how should libertarians think about a conflict like this? Just big picture. Is there a kind of a libertarian principle to apply to a situation like Russia invades Ukraine and then Ukraine is like, we can't continue this conflict. We can't continue to fight the aggressor without American bombs.
I mean, I do think the key libertarian principle is the right to self-defense, which is ultimately what is happening here, right? Like, Ukraine is defending itself. But as in all applications of the right to self-defense, you do not have the right to infinite access to other people's resources in order to conduct that self-defense. And that is the place where people tend to get confused. Even if the cause is just, people may still, for whatever reason, choose not to help you. And of course, if we're talking about, you know, money being taken via taxation and given without the consent of the givers to a cause they may or may not support, that gets even trickier. I do think that, like, maybe I'm just being naive, but it does seem like a very, very key thing in this question of territorial concessions is the Ukrainian constitution says that it has to go to a referendum. And like 80% of Ukraine says we will never cede any territory to Putin. So I'm not exactly sure how they're planning to get around that. And I, for one, think constitutions should be respected and honored, especially ones like the Constitution of Ukraine, which is a pretty good one as far as constitutions go.
Respect the Constitution, says libertarian editor. All right, big news here at the end of the podcast. Let's move on to our final segment. What have you been watching, reading, otherwise consuming in the cultural realm? Nick Gillespie, let's start with you.
So in keeping with my Texas-themed consumption over the past couple of weeks, where I, among other things, I went to Ron Paul's 90th barbecue birthday party, I finished watching the new season of King of the Hill, which comes on, you know, after, I think, like 13 years. Pause. King of the Hill is set in the fictional Dallas suburb of Arlen, Texas. And it had a tremendous run the first time where it really tweaked the sensibilities both of twig boy liberalism as well as really dumb reactionary conservatism. In this, Hank and Peggy Hill return from spending years in Saudi Arabia, as Peggy insists on calling it, where they were working for a petrochemical company, or Hank was. And it's a really good pickup of where the, you know, where the series had left off. Bobby Hill is now in his early 20s. His friend Joseph and his old neighbor and girlfriend Connie are, you know, young adults going to college or not. Bobby runs a fusion restaurant, a German-Japanese fusion restaurant. It's a really good show that maybe, you know, and I talked about Idiocracy. This is by Mike Judge. You know, this might, it provides a lot of Brando moments, actually, because King of the Hill was never clearly political one way or the other. It was clearly skeptical of kind of a right-wing reactionary conservatism that was in Texas, as well as the kind of hyper-liberalism, you know, the Molly Ivins kind of liberalism of Texas as well. And it splits the difference again here, and it shows a way in which people who disagree with each other about fundamental things can nonetheless be human and kind and interesting and good to each other. So I recommend King of the Hill. It's very funny. There is an episode where Hank, when he was in Saudi Arabia, had become a fan of soccer, which, you know, in King of the Hill world, as it was in 1970s America, was synonymous with socialism and homosexuality. So it's a big thing for Hank to admit that he likes soccer, and he actually becomes a soccer ref. Hilarity and chaos ensues. It's King of the Hill reboot is really good, and I hope there's another season in the offing.
This just makes me think. We had this conversation about South Park a couple of weeks on this show, that like libertarians need to add cartoons for adults as like two magicians. Yeah, yeah. As like the
cultural
media.
Get rid of magicians. Bring in the card. Yeah, the Adult Swim animation stuff. Yeah.
And I'm not saying Mike Judge is a libertarian or has described himself as a libertarian or anything like that, but there's clearly a kind of libertarian spirit, even if it's unacknowledged, that runs through his work. Matt Welch, what do you have for us?
So in my never-ending bingo card of dadcore documentary watching, I'm going to get through the entire Ken Burns catalog at some point.
Come on. We don't have enough Ken Burns. Yeah.
I watched one that I was very reluctant to watch because of its title, which is The National Parks, America's Greatest Idea, I think is the name of it. Why is that funny? Why is that funny? Just
go ahead. Tell us, Matt.
If we have to explain it to you, you wouldn't understand.
Okay.
Like, eventually there's going to be a Ken Burns documentary on this beautiful stick.
I hope so. Watch the hell out of that.
And the,
the revolutionary thing coming to this fall. It's going to be awesome. So it is like the name actually comes, it's not just his editorial comment a little, it is, but that came from an early discussion about how it hadn't really been done, that kind of national park in geopolitics, according to the claims of this. It came out in 2009. It's not as good as his later stuff, especially the Roosevelt's documentary, the Buffalo documentary, other ones that I've talked about on this show, in like finding the controlled opposition to talk about. They didn't have like a skeptical George Will in here that you always need to make these documentaries better. He's pretty enthusiastic about it. But what I would recommend it for, besides just the wonderful footage of the national parks, which are gorgeous to look at, and the interesting other bits, is that John Muir, and I knew John Muir, I know he's from California, have some familiarity with his work. He's a very strange man, but the documentary does good job of sort of showcasing his religious ecstasy of his environmentalism, that is just strange. It's I think specifically American in orientation, very lyrical, beautiful, also like shrill and uncompromising, and strange. And I just found it very moving to watch that bit. And then there's this this great meeting between Teddy Roosevelt and John Muir, where they just kind of go tramping in the woods in California in like 1907 or 8 for a few days. That sounds really fascinating. I just bought a book to read more about it. It does not linger as much as it should on the idea of what happens when you have this incredible new power that didn't exist before in the hands of one person, who will then use it to completely expand and also do things that the John Muirs of the world hate. It doesn't really linger on that as much as it could. So definitely has some flaws from a libertarian point of view, but just very fascinating and beautiful look at a strange American invention.
What's your favorite national park, Matt Welch?
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that question right now. I have visited a precious few. I'm from California, and I've only driven through Yosemite once at night. I can't tell you. I hope to have a much more thoroughgoing answer 18 months from now. I'm going to visit quite a few.
So my cultural consumption is also about a great American space. It is the novel Glass Century by Ross Barkin, and it is a big sprawling book about New York from the 1970s through now. It's primarily about a couple who engage in a long-running, very complicated affair, totally separate and parallel world, like apart from their ordinary lives. He is like works in politics, and so you sort of get political connections through him. She ends up as a photographer for the Daily News, the New York Post, and publications like that. But what's interesting about this book is that it treats New York City in kind of the same way as this kind of separate parallel space. Part of what's fascinating about this book is just how it positions New York as a kind of entire political cultural universe, almost like if you think of the way that Gotham in the Batman comics, like there's no rest of the world in the Batman comics. Yes, I know. Sometimes we go to Metropolis and it's all set in America, but like Gotham is the whole place, right? And so in this book, New York is its own complete world, but it's also a microcosm of America that reverberates outward. And there's this, like early in the book, I think it's chapter 5 or 6, you get a scene in the 1970s where we meet young Donald Trump as a 20-something and his father, who is demanding special tax abatements for developers that are going to like last basically forever for decades, right? There's this whole extended sequence about crime fears in the 1970s, quite a bit about the press wars of that era, and then on into the 1990s. Ross Barkin is a journalist. It's not that surprising that he would go that route. Later in the book, of course, we get September 11th and Rudy Giuliani, and then the subsequent drop in crime, and eventually COVID is sort of the epilogue to this book. And what you see through all of this, through like 50 years of New York story, is that New York is its own total universe. But it's also it's also like the leading edge for the rest of us. It's the place where everything happens. Everything happens the most and also first. And it's just a really great, fascinating kind of Forrest Gumpy kind of book that treats New York and like the world of New York as its subject. The other thing that's interesting about this is that Ross Barkin on his Substack has been writing earlier this year. I think he's kind of said, I'm not going to do this anymore, but just about like the decline in white male literary fiction, especially for younger writers, and just how hard it was for him putting this book out to publishers. I think he got rejected by something like 20 publishers, and he's like, yes, he is like basically said, look, if you look at the numbers, he's you know, like it is increasingly difficult for white male authors who are under the age of 35 or 40 to get published in literary fiction specifically in the last decade or so. And so kind of interesting to see what he then does is sort of with in that environment. And it's a great book. Catherine, what do you have for us?
I was at the beach last week, and I make a point when I'm in Rehoboth, where I go every year, to go to Browse About Books, which is a super excellent beach bookstore, and just buy some Dead Tree books and read them in the sand, because that is fun. I picked for one of my books actually first novel by Costanza Casati, Clytemnestra. I had previously read her Babylonia, which was her second book. Really a lot of murder and rape for a beach book. This is a retelling, of course, of the classical story of a daughter of a king married to another king, lots of child death, lots of rape, lots of murder, lots of kind of adjacency to all of the great Greek stories that you know. Robbie Suave was on the podcast recently, and he mentioned Madeline Miller Searcy. I am basically just always chasing the high of that book, which is one of the greatest modern retellings of Greek myth. This one's pretty good. The thing that is most interesting about it is the sort of emotional note of the entire book is rage. She is just fucking pissed. Like, people keep taking her children and sacrificing them to the gods, and she is not happy about it, or to politics. And so I think that's like, if we're doing a libertarian lesson of Clytemnestra's story, which is a little bit of a stretch, it's just like, I finished the book and found myself grateful to be a woman living in the modern age rather than in ancient times. And also, just a reminder that politics is violence, and that was very, very, very much closer to the surface in those days, and something that sort of people, at least of a certain class, reckoned with all the time. So,
can you fit it into a free-range parenting model?
Well, so she is depicted as being Spartan, and so we do see a Spartan
more of a
upbringing.
Tiger mom.
And I would say, yes, it's a little bit more of a why don't you go spend the night sleeping in the woods above the gorge where we throw our unworthy infants kind of parenting rather than helicopter parenting. But so I do recommend it to you if you are at all in favor of any kind of modern retelling of a myth in a novelistic form. Clytemnestra by Costanza Casati.
Sounds like the ancients needed Brando moments, too. Okay, folks, that is our show for this week. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.
Evangeline, your life, seen you trying. What's your